according to the police officer I spoke to, they went through a list of questions in order to ascertain whether or not she was safe and determined that she was okay to be on her own on the streets of Victoria, barefoot in November, and they left her there. That was the last time anyone ever saw her.
You are listening to Emma Filipov is Missing, an ongoing series by the Nighttime Podcast.
Welcome to part 5 of an ongoing series covering the still unexplained disappearance of Emma Filipov, who was last seen by the Victoria police officers who left her standing shoeless on a busy intersection in November of 2012. As I described in the prior entry in this series, I'm now working on several episodes dedicated to this case, in which I'll feature guests who were close to Emma during key moments of this tragic story. I've been attempting to present these episodes in a sort of chronological order based on when our guests' lives were the closest with Emma's. I felt in doing so, we'd have the best possible vantage point to witness Emma's gradual transition into the young woman we would eventually see in the 7-Eleven surveillance footage. During part 4 of this series, we heard from Emma's childhood best friend Ellen, who provided insight into Emma's life and personality, all the while focusing on the time period spanning from elementary school leading into young adulthood. Tonight, our focus will move forward beyond where we left off with Ellen. We'll now get an inside view of Emma's arrival to Victoria and the time immediately following it, to provide us the necessary perspective on this crucial yet little-known part of Emma's life. We'll hear from the lifelong friend who Emma shared a modest apartment with upon her arrival in Victoria. Tonight's episode will feature my recent conversation with Emma's close friend Michaela, and immediately following the talk with Michaela, we'll be joined again by Tim and Lance, hosts of the Missing Maura Murray podcast. Before we get to the conversation with Michaela, I want to recap the timeline and give you a few things to listen for. Had I been more organized from the beginning of the series, I would have released the prior 2 episodes in a slightly different order. Ellen would have come first, focusing on Emma's adolescence, and then Julian would be next, providing a look at Emma just prior to her leaving for Victoria. When presented in this way, I felt it provides a clear view of Emma being slowly burdened by a mental health struggle. Ellen shared details of the first warning signs, the secretive behavior, the long walks. Then we'd meet Julian and get an inside view of these long walks and get to hear how Emma was perceived by someone unfamiliar with her eccentricities. Ellen and then Julian would bring us to our next guest in our current step in this series. We'll pick up this story a year prior to Emma's disappearance in fall of 2011, just after Emma went west, leaving Julian behind. During the upcoming talk with Michaela, consider what you heard Ellen and Julian describe. Personally, I was surprised by a lot of what Michaela shared. In hindsight, it's clear things were on a downward spiral for some time. But as you'll hear, a year prior to Emma's disappearance, things were going bad fast. I'll next cut to my talk with Michaela, but first I want to apologize for the audio quality. This was a telephone call recorded under less than ideal circumstances, but with that said, I think you'll hear that the power of the content more than makes up for any technical imperfections. Our conversation starts with Michaela describing her relationship with Emma.
I met Emma when I was a baby, really. We both grew up in Lanark, and our families were friends. So our relationship was one of childhood friendship. We both enjoyed spending a lot of time outside, painting together when we were kids, playing make-believe games. So I think that, at its core, is what led us to be so close. And then also, I mean, just that our families were friends, so we saw each other all the time growing up. Our brothers were really good friends. Our other younger brothers were really good friends, so a lot of family connection.
Right.
And then we would have distance but reconnect periodically throughout our lives, right up until Emma came out to Victoria, where she lived with me.
During your life with Emma, what period of time would you have been the closest and been together most often?
I think we were closest when we were living together up west. That was initially when Emma landed out in Victoria. We were also very close as children, but in our sort of adult lives, definitely when we were living together in Victoria was when we were closest.
I understand when Emma first arrived in Victoria, which I think was late 2011, she arrived and landed with you, living with you in your apartment. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. So I was living out west, going to law school. I was with my partner, Chris, at the time. We'd reconnected in the summer of 2011 when I was in Perth, in Lanark, and then we saw each other in Perth, and reconnected. Emma said that she was considering coming out west, and I let her know that if she did, she had a place to stay. So she landed at our place when she first came to Victoria. That would have been in October, I believe, of 2011. And then she lived with us until the end of December. Though for part of that time, she had her own place just in the apartment next to our same building.
When she did arrive in Victoria, do you know what it was that brought her there and what her plans were? Like, what was the reason she moved there?
She didn't have specific plans in terms of work or school or anything like that. She came out west, she said, because she felt drawn to Victoria. She would say that she felt it was the center of something important, some kind of change that was coming. She didn't really get into details. For her, I think it was just a feeling of being drawn to Victoria and there being some importance in her being there. So that's really why she, I think, at least that's what she expressed to me as the reason why she was coming to Victoria.
Now, can you describe your time living with her? Like when she was there with you in Victoria at this point, about a year prior to her disappearance, can you describe how she spent her time? What kind of things she was up to?
Sure. She spent a lot of time by herself. She wanted to be outside a lot, so she would go on these really long walks, like 8 hours sometimes, all day, even sometimes at night for many hours. And she would go by the beach. She would bring back pieces of nature. So at one point, she'd brought back so many rocks from the beach that she'd filled our table with this like elaborate, quite beautiful design. So she would just walk and walk. I know that I was sort of curious about what she was doing on these really long walks. And I remember she invited me once to come with her, and she showed me that she was walking down the streets of the suburbs in Victoria and taking all the leaves that had been piled by folks who'd raked up their lawns, that were taking all the leaves and spreading them everywhere. So she felt that she needed to sort of spread the leaves over the streets, over the sidewalks. And she explained to me that for her, this was really important work that would help nature sort of regenerate, regrow. Didn't really make sense to me. Yeah, I mean, that's how she was spending her time, and for her it was important that she do this.
Did you have fear that her mental health was deteriorating, or did this just seem like creative, adventurous Emma on an interesting journey?
I mean, for me, I was definitely concerned. Emma had always been very creative. She always enjoyed being in nature. But the way that she spoke about what she was doing and sort of the way she was doing this, she seemed to feel compelled to do it. Like, she would often talk as though it wasn't much of a choice. She was completely exhausting herself, like she was barely sleeping, and just spending so much time walking. It really did seem, in the way that she was speaking about it, that she felt like she had to do this. Mm-hmm. So I was concerned about her. I was trying to navigate sort of maintaining that close connection and being supportive, but also recognizing that her mental health did seem to be deteriorating. I was definitely worried about that.
Over the years, from childhood up until the point that she was living with you, now appearing to act strange, do you recall seeing a gradual change in Emma, or was it more of a shock when she arrived and was doing this unusual stuff?
I remember when we reconnected in Perth before she came out west. You know, like Emma's always been very creative and had very poetic. She's always kind of spoken in poetic ways. So there was her ways of relating to the world when we reconnected in Perth. We're definitely getting, they seemed quirkier than I remembered. But I wasn't concerned. It's like fun, quirky Emma. But when she came out west, I think is really when I noticed a change. Because she, at that point, some of the ways that she was acting, it didn't seem like it was a choice she was making. Like, I didn't think that she seemed happy to be going on these walks and to be, you know, spending her time, like, spreading these leaves, and she would often stay up all night writing. She was writing a lot of stories, and for her, the way she expressed herself, she was really trying to sort of figure out what significance of Victoria was and why she had to be there and what change was coming. She would often speak about something that was going to be changing soon, but it was all very abstract. Yeah, so I mean, I definitely noticed more of a shift in Victoria and I.
This writing you talked about in the stories that she was writing, did you have the opportunity to read her stories? Like, was it fiction, like short stories, or was it more like the journaling as I've heard it described, where she was kind of in poetic style, you know, outlining her day-to-day activity?
So, yeah, I mean, she was journaling. She did share one of her poems with me and with my partner. I remember it was very emotional for her to share it. When she was sharing it, she was shaking, she was crying, and she said that for her, she really wanted us to understand sort of the significance of it for her. And she felt, you know, because she was very isolated, so she was living with me and my partner, spending a lot of time by herself or with us, but really in her head. And so this poem she shared, she wanted us to sort of grasp the significance of. It was about her being the moon, and one of us being the sun, and there was some significance in the way that we were connected to the cosmos for her, and we were meant to be the center of some kind of change. So she'd really constructed this narrative of importance that implicated us, and I remember connecting with my partner after and talking about it, we were really worried because it seemed to be beyond just journaling about her day to day in a poetic way, but it really, like, it obviously shook her what the meaning behind it, which we didn't understand. Like, I didn't understand what the meaning was, and I think that upset her that I didn't understand it. So yeah, I mean, it was journaling, but it was
much much deeper than that.
Yeah, it was more. It meant a lot for her, but it didn't make sense to me because I wasn't there. So I think it speaks to sort of what was going on with her mental health. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I was almost seeing a bit of a break from reality.
Did you reach out to anyone for help or confront Emma with what you were seeing?
I reached out to people that were close to Emma and let them know what I was seeing without sharing some of the really intimate details of what Emma was sharing with me. I just sort of said that I was concerned and gave enough information to sort of convey what she was doing that would cause concern. I also connected with some mental health resources to ask for advice on what to do, and with some friends who worked in that area. And I mean, essentially the feedback I got was on ways that I could try to intervene a bit, but obviously nothing can happen without Emma's consent. I talked to Emma a little bit about whether she considered that her mental health was not good and whether she thought of trying to get treatment, but she wasn't very receptive. She said it would kind of hamper her creativity, and she didn't think that her mental health was really a problem that needed any kind of medical intervention. She kind of wanted to keep doing what she felt she needed to do on her own. So she wasn't very receptive to any kind of treatment or even recognizing that there was much of a problem. So beyond that, I didn't really know what to do. I just tried to be as supportive as I could. Being there for Emma, talking to her when she wanted to, joining her on some of her walks. So just trying to be as supportive as I could be, not knowing what else I should be doing.
Now, I understand she was with you, as you said, I think from October 2011 to just about December of 2012. When she left your home to live on her own, what was the reason for that? Why did she move out with you?
So she was with me for just a few months, and initially I found a place for her. When she came to live with us, I thought it was just sort of a temporary thing, like she'd crash there for a little while until she got her feet under her. But as I was seeing her mental health sort of deteriorate, and she wasn't getting work or looking for work at that point, so I actually helped find a place for her next to where I was living. And I know she was in touch with her dad a bit, so yeah, anyhow, she was able to get a place. She wasn't working, but I think she managed to pay for it for a little while anyways. So initially she was my neighbor when she moved out.
Okay.
She was in the same building, but she was my neighbor. She had her own place. After that, the reason why we parted ways is I actually had a job in the Philippines. So I went there. I moved to the Philippines, and we fell out of touch until I came back about 8 months later.
Okay. During your time living with Emma and Victoria, and immediately after she left, did you know her to be involved with drugs or alcohol or anything along those lines that would explain her behavior?
No, in fact, she steered away from it. Like, she said that it made her feel awful. Like, so she didn't take any drugs or anything. When I was with her, she was even really hesitant to put certain things, like certain foods, into her body. So I know she had some issues with what she felt good eating, and it would change too. But at different points, anything that was living or had been living, even I think at one point it even involved like a fruit of a tree. She didn't want to eat because she was worried it would harm nature. So she was eating a very limited diet, and definitely not having any alcohol or drugs.
Other people who've spoke to me or have spoken about their relationship with Emma described her being very private, but slowly going from private to more so paranoid in fear of people knowing, you know, where she was and what she was doing. Did you see the paranoia developing when she was living with you?
Yes. She was definitely very private. It was obviously hard for her to share elements of her world. As I thought when she did try to share pieces of it with me. And I saw the beginnings of paranoia. She would sort of let somebody close and then get really scared and disappear from them. Yeah, so I saw the beginnings of that, just not feeling comfortable or safe around people.
Okay.
And pushing them away quickly.
When she left from your home, living as a neighbor, again, you left to go to the Philippines, and I think you said you reconnected about 8 months later. When you returned to Victoria from the Philippines and reconnected with Emma, do you know where she was living at that point?
So I came back in 2012, in October 2012. Yeah, I mean, so I said we reconnected. I emailed her. She initially emailed me in October. I emailed her back, and I actually didn't know where she was living. Apparently she was living at the women's shelter at that time,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't know that. So I emailed her back and didn't hear back. And that's when I found out, I think not that long after that she had disappeared. Yeah, that's why, I mean, when I came back, I thought everything was fine, and I was, yeah, devastated and completely shocked once I learned that she disappeared and that she'd actually been living at a homeless shelter. I thought she had housing, and yeah.
You didn't know it had gone that far.
No, I mean, she'd even, in her email to me, she seemed really good. Like, her update around how she was doing didn't indicate at all that she was living in a shelter. She seemed happy in her email. Like, in retrospect, I remember thinking, like I don't know if she was reaching out without saying that she was looking for help. Like, and then I started thinking after, like, I should have emailed her back faster, offered a place to stay, but she did seem really well. Like, she didn't convey at all what was going on with her. So I didn't know. I was shocked.
Can you tell me, if you don't mind, tell me about how you found out that she was missing. How did you get this news?
I found out that she was missing. I think it was through her mother. I can't recall though if it was through my family or her mother directly. It was kind of a bit of a blur, but it was definitely when her mother arrived that I found out.
Were you involved in Shelley's search for Emma when Shelley was in Victoria doing that?
I spent time with Shelley. I met up with Shelley and some of the team that were looking for her. I think I put up a few posters and like shared information online and that kind of thing that my friends know who knew her. And yeah, I mean, did the little bit that I could to help out. I was in the middle of law school exams too, so I was struggling a bit, and it was it was just so devastating. So I was as involved with the search as I felt like I could be, and just more wanting to support Emma's mom. Mm-hmm.
Leading up to Emma's disappearance, as well as during her time living with you, many people talk, as I mentioned, about her paranoia and ideas that she maybe could have been stalked or been involved in crime or had some types of problems with some people that could have been a danger to her. Were you aware of anything of this nature, like any reason for her to have a reasonable concern for her well-being or any people that could have been, you know, a risk for her?
When she was staying with me, I wasn't aware of anybody that could have posed a risk to her safety. I mean, she was really private and really hesitant to connect with people at that time. But she would also, because when she did let you in, when she did open up, I mean, she was really vulnerable and she was really compassionate. So she would make space for people and feel empathy for people, some of whom maybe weren't that well intentioned. So I mean, she would connect to some folks that seemed a little that I was unsure of.
Okay.
But it, I mean, I didn't fear for her safety. Yeah, no, I didn't, and I didn't feel like she was involved with anybody that was connected to any sort of criminal activity or anything like that. I mean, and that could have shifted in the time that I was away. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
Or during the shelter, she likely met people that you wouldn't have known her to associate with, I assume.
Yeah, and she did make space for everybody. Like, she would, which I admired, you know. But because of where she was at, I think it made her a little vulnerable. Like, she would connect to somebody who was, you know, struggling with homelessness or addiction just as quickly as she was connect to somebody who was, I don't know, like a employed business person. Like, she didn't discriminate, you know, she connected to all humans, all people, depending on, you know, if she felt that there's space in her heart for them. So I liked that about her, but I think it did make her a little vulnerable.
You mentioned these emailed updates that you had with Emma. Do you recall roughly when your last communication was with Emma?
It was really shortly before she disappeared. I'd emailed her and suggested that we meet up. I think it was actually within like days of her disappearing, and then I just didn't hear back, and then I got the update that she disappeared. Yeah, it's just horrifying.
The last message that you had received from her, was there anything unusual about it that would have, you know, set you off to be concerned, or was it just, you know, a typical message like the others you would have received from her?
It was optimistic, actually, her message. It didn't raise any alarm bells for me. You know, it was sort of like poetically written, like, which is common way for Emma to express herself. It was optimistic, and I wasn't concerned, so. Mm-hmm. And I think obviously she was holding back. Like, when we were living together is when I felt like I really saw sort of where she was at that time. But yeah, when she was reaching out by email, it was like quite, it wasn't concerning at all. Which, yeah, so I was shocked when I learned that she disappeared and that she was so unwell leading up to her disappearance.
And, you know, when people consider where Emma is and her possible fate, some talk about her possibly suffering from severe depression. You just explained her last message to you as being optimistic. Did you see any signs of depression? What you described to me, it does sound like she was on well with the manic behavior with the leaves and some paranoia and whatnot. But did you have any reason to believe she was actually depressed?
Well, when we were living together, for sure, yeah, she did seem like really up and down, and often when she was not in a good place, like, yes, definitely depressed. Yeah, she seemed sometimes often like she would sort of oscillate between manic behavior and what seemed like severe depression. She just would sometimes, once she did get her own place, spend days inside, and yeah, she definitely did at points seem quite depressed.
Being close to her as you are and knowing so much about her prior to her disappearance, do you have an opinion on what became of Emma, and if so, are you comfortable sharing it?
I'd like to think that Emma chose to leave and go somewhere that she feels good in. I think that possibly she's just hiding. I don't, that would be the best scenario, I think. I mean, she was really vulnerable. I like to think that she's just hiding.
I'd like to thank Michaela for being so generous and sharing such intimate moments. I certainly feel as though I'm a step closer to understanding Emma after seeing these moments from Michaela's perspective. Next, I'll cut to a conversation I had with Tim and Lance of the Missing Maura Murray podcast. Together, the three of us listened to the talk you just heard with Michaela, and we shared our thoughts. We'll start with Tim and Lance sharing some details of their newly launched podcast, Crawl Space. You were most recently on this show during episode 2 of this series covering Emma's disappearance. I understand you've been very busy since then. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your new project, Crawl Space?
Yeah, it's a very exciting podcast that we just launched about a month ago called Crawl Space. It's another true crime podcast, a lot like our other podcast, Missing Maura Murray, but we are going to cover much more than one case. Right now, we're talking about the Brianna Maitland disappearance.
We'll try to cover each case with as much detail as we've covered Maura's case.
And you took on a third co-host, Chloe, right?
Yeah, Chloe. She's a psychological counselor, and she probably doubles our collective IQ.
Maybe not quite doubles mine, but...
triples yours then.
So we'll get to the topic at hand now. So at this point in Emma's life, again, now where she's just arrived in Victoria, this is about a year prior to her disappearance. It was surprising to me how obvious her mental health problem was, and how clear it was. Things have progressed since what Ellen described, and things are already, way off the rails, a year before she'd last be seen. Did you guys have the same reaction?
The progression, I would say, is the scariest thing, because without that, like we were saying earlier, I can't really tell what's Emma being artistic or Emma being potentially unstable in some way. But the progression makes it pretty obvious, because where are you going to go? What's going to happen next?
Mm-hmm. Right. And as a friend or someone who's close to her, how long does it take before you start realizing this isn't somebody who's being an artistic force? This is actual mental deterioration. And then what do you do? How many people do each of us know remind us of Emma? Tim and I have a mutual friend who lives on the West Coast that, I mean, there's many times where I could probably say, he's peculiar. He does peculiar things, but I would never say that he's got a mental deterioration happening. I think that he has ideas that he sometimes can't communicate because they're a little bit bigger than what's out there right now. Perhaps that's like frustrating to people like that. So what do you do?
Yeah, and I think Michaela saw the difference when she described going on the long walks with Emma, moving the leaves around, and she said it didn't seem like it was something Emma enjoyed doing. It seemed like she was, like it was a job and her responsibility to do this. And she was, staying up all night, not eating well, doing this. Like, that's kind of, I think, when she probably, it probably freaked her out a bit, I'm thinking.
Yeah, the fact that it was almost like an obligation to her, I would say, is kind of frightening. I don't know what to do there, though, if you're her friend. I mean, we've all had friends who have been unstable, I think, and you try your best, right? But I don't know what to do.
Yeah,
you never know what to do.
Right.
You just try your best.
In hindsight's 2020, like knowing now, she wouldn't have, like, Michaela would have had no way to know something like that would happen. Yet Michaela did, I think, what was reasonable, and she did seek out help, and she talked to Emma, or tried to talk to Emma. When you're younger, living with a friend, there's only, and they're doing stuff that maybe you're questioning, there's only so much that you can do. So I think everything Michaela did was what a reasonable, what a reasonable person would do.
Yeah, she definitely had compassion for her. She did more than what I would expect somebody to do. And she seemed particularly, and maybe I was misreading it, but she seemed particularly like disturbed, maybe a little bit disturbed when she went overseas for work and returned and she received the email from Emma and she wrote back and then she never heard back. And during that time eventually Emma becomes a missing person. I feel like there's something in Michaela right now where it's very open-ended. She needs some closure there.
I can't imagine what it would be like. Yeah. And she described it as that last email she got from Emma to be like a positive, kind of uplifting, hopeful message. So she said there was nothing in there to indicate, that things were going really wrong.
Not to be, I guess devil's advocate is a lot of people who plan to commit suicide will usually seem the most positive and optimistic before they do the act of killing themselves, because it's a therapeutic thing to come to terms with the fact that you're going to do it. So it gives them this rush of optimism. But I don't know if she'd ever do that in an email.
Yeah, and I think it also could have just been like keeping up appearances and not wanting to, if she was, felt like she was backed into a corner and paranoid and all that, she may have just wanted, just to please people and make people just, everything's fine. Just, hopefully we will find out from Emma what her intentions were with all this. But at this point, it's up for debate. Also, one thing that Michaela had told me that I had never heard before and I thought was interesting was Emma's reason even for being in Victoria. It was just, Michaela described it as that she had expected something important to happen in Victoria and she wanted to be a part of it. She just had this, you know, this vague belief that something big was going on. And that kind of makes me wonder, did she go to Victoria already under in a pretty serious state of psychosis? Like, to, I don't know what she was expecting to happen there, but it seemed like that wouldn't be a reasonable reason, you know, to move to a new city.
Yeah, she said she was drawn to Victoria, and Michaela mentioned that a few times, that, you know, it was this thing about the town and it was this thing about something was going to happen there. What would be there to draw her there?
I've been there. It's really nice.
Yeah.
It's right on the water. It's right across the bay, I guess, from Vancouver. I mean, it is extremely beautiful. There is a lot of wilderness there too.
This reason for going, it wasn't like a passive feeling. It was, you know, it was obviously very important to Emma, and it was something she really, you know, really believed in. Now, comparing or thinking of these two episodes, hearing Ellen describe childhood, Michaela describe Emma's first arriving in Victoria, what you've heard in these interviews, how it supports what we talked about in episode two was the three possible outcomes being Emma was met with foul play, Emma was met her end with possibly a suicide or unintentional death, or the third being that she's currently living a transient life. I'll tell you how these two interviews affected my thoughts about them is Ellen describing Emma's relationship with her younger brother makes me question whether or not she would be willing or would be able to live on her own and not reach out and get in touch. Emma had so much to live for with so many close friends, a family who was so close and cared so much for her. It's hard to imagine that she would decide to end her own life. That being said, when we heard Michaela, it's obvious that her mental health was very, very bad, and she was already in crisis a year before she disappeared. Then as far as foul play, there'd be no question in my mind that she would be vulnerable. And then on top of that, she was left alone on a cold night without her shoes on a busy intersection. So she was, you know, the perfect victim waiting there with all these other things, you know, mounting up behind her.
Yeah, definitely her psychological well-being having seemingly slipped, it would lead you to believe that there was either a suicide or an accidental death. But like you said, she was shoeless at one point, one of the last times she was seen, and you know, and maybe a little distraught. So that would also put her pretty high on like a victimology rating. You know, she's sort of a perfect target at that point.
I mean, I can't. It's really tough to even come up with a scenario that makes sense for any of those. All you can do is just say you hope she's alive. And if she's alive, what scenario is that? That's the one where she's living a transient life. But then where is she? And who picked her up? Did somebody pick her up and take her to a shelter that night? And then she just kind of got lost in the mix and left. And she hitchhiked and went, you know, miles away to another shelter and just kind of got lost in the mix of the homeless population.
Yeah, I think it's a possibility. She could definitely blend in there as a homeless person, you know, with a network of people. There's no question she could.
Yeah, I don't even think that she would be doing it intentionally. I think she's just in with all of the other like-behaviored people, if that were to happen.
Yeah, it's just the case is well enough known that in 5 years you'd think somebody would have come across her. Like, is this like the Finding Emma documentary that was on CBC when that aired? That was a major documentary a lot of people have seen. People who are, let's say, if you work at a shelter, you may follow that sort of programming on TV, and you likely would have come across Emma's story And then you would have run into Emma at the shelter. Like, I can't imagine that she managed to go undetected for 5 years unless somehow she got out of the country and, you know, completely went off the grid in that way. But then at the same time, her mental health was so poor, or seemingly so poor, that I don't know how she'd be able to navigate getting out of the country or finding her way somewhere where she wouldn't easily be detected.
I mean, I know that there are woods there. There's water there. I mean, did she go walking into the woods by herself? I don't know. Now I feel like I sound like a lot of people who just start listening to the Maura Murray podcast.
Right.
She just walked into the woods. And it is frustrating hearing that.
I'd like to thank Tim and Lance for joining me, and I encourage you to check out both their shows. And with that, we'll conclude tonight's episode. If you'd like to learn more about Emma's disappearance, please visit helpfindemmafilipoff.com. To take part in strategizing and support those searching for Emma, please join the Help Find Emma Filipoff discussion group on Facebook. If you have any information on Emma's disappearance or current whereabouts, please contact Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-TIPS. That's 1-800-222-8477. Part 6 of this series will be released in the coming months, with Parts 7 and 8 currently under production. If you're interested in hearing more content, please check out the Nighttime Patron Group, where for $1 a month, you'll have access to my bonus content. You can join by visiting patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. That's patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. On behalf of myself and the show's listeners, I'd like to thank the continued support of the current patrons and welcome the newest members of the group, Mr. Cosgrove, Vince, Van Recken, Paul, Santa, and Deborah. Without you all, the production of the show would be impossible. I'd like to thank you for listening to the show. If you enjoy your time here, please rate, review, and subscribe on whichever podcast platform you use. To stay up to date, follow me on Facebook and on Twitter and Instagram, where my handle is @nighttimepod. If you have any story ideas or want to provide feedback on the show, I always enjoy hearing from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.